Quite a few people told me they weren't going to make it this morning, so that means that we all have to make up for the ones who aren't here in order to fill out the discussion. Glad that you were able to make it. Glad that the ice did not, did not prevent anyone who's here anyway, from being here. You will note that on the top of the sheet it says 4 when science and Torah clash 4. Yes, I know it's week 5, but it's topic number 4 because we bled over from one week into the next. So we're on our 4th topic, our 5th week. And I gave you a little note at the top, just a little bit of a recap of where we've been, because some of the discussions have sort of blended into each other a little bit, I think. So we've talked about reasons why Torah would reject scientific evidence or scientific theory, such that when there's a clash, you will find people who will say, well, I don't accept whatever it is that the scientists are saying. We talked about it in terms of divine authority, challenges to the scientific model, the argument that the law is the law within Torah regardless of what science says it is and take it into consideration, the idea of honoring tradition, and this is what tradition has always said, and therefore this is what we interpret and what we understand. And then the second area was the set of options for reconciling Torah and science. We talked about it in the context of Copernicus and the idea that everything is going around the sun versus around the earth. And we talked about it last week at length in terms of the age of the universe. And so we saw the approaches of suggesting that maybe the sages were wrong because they didn't have the science that others did. They were working with the science that others do now. They were working with the science of their day. We talked about reinterpreting Torah in light of new information. We talked about drawing on old sources and re-explaining them in such a way that they actually can be read to predict that which science has discovered. And what we're going to do this week now is to look at another key question, and it's one that we've already touched on, but I want to spend some time on it. And that is, as I put it on your sheet, is Torah a medical textbook? Meaning, is there an assumption that the Torah, the sages, are aware of medical knowledge, medical information? Should there be any sort of assumption that Rabbi so-and-so, living in the 21st century, or living in the 1st century, or living before, would know, in the case at hand, medicine, but it's really, science at large, should they have access to that kind of information? We're going to see.
You mean like, is it hidden in the Torah?
Or not even hidden, per se. But yeah, the question of, if you were, to put it differently, if you were to be an excellent student of Torah, who would sit and study for hours and hours and days and months and years, you would eventually figure out quantum physics. Should there be any such assumption that Torah includes that within it? Because we will see that there are those who have that assumption. I'm not, picking that out of a hat in order to ask a question. The assumption is there, and it has practical ramifications. It's not just an interesting theoretical question of, could I learn Bereishit and figure out how the universe came to be if I just learn it deep enough? It actually has practical applications. Why does it have practical applications? Why is this a practical problem? And not only a hypothetical one, a theoretical one?
We allow them to pascula, to diagnose. It's a gift offered to rabbis, right to diagnose them.
Ah, so Diane says, well, if everything is really within Torah, then maybe the rabbi should be able to weigh in on medical situations. So that would be one question. I admit I was thinking about it something a little bit different, but you're right, that raises it from that perspective, and we're actually going to see a case like that in a little bit. Yeah?
Certain medical situations may require halakhic decisions.
Right. There are halakhic decisions, there are laws that actually revolve around medical information, that are affected by medical information. I gave you a few examples here, just to spell it out. First, source number 1, we talked about this briefly in an earlier week, and this is the meat and fish issue, the idea of not eating meat and fish together. So it comes to a passage in the Talmud in source number 1. Rava from Parzikia. You could actually pronounce it different ways. It's not clear if that was actually the name of the place, but we're going to go with Parziki as the pronunciation. He prohibited people from eating fish with a dairy dish if it had been roasted with meat. This was not a medical thing. This was a halachic thing. Even though fish itself is parif, it's not considered meat, it's not considered dairy within Jewish law, if somebody roasted fish in the same place as he roasted meat, alongside meat, then he felt the fish had absorbed some element of the meat through the steam, through the smell, whatever it was, and therefore you couldn't eat it with dairy. And that's its own discussion about whether a person needs two ovens and so on and so forth. Mar Bar Rav Ashi taught, it is even prohibited to eat this with plain salt. He says, forget the question of eating the fish with dairy. Once fish is roasted with meat, you're not allowed to eat it at all, because it's unhealthy. It is bad for smell, and for davar acher, for another ailment, which the commentators render there as some kind of skin problem. Some have suggested possibly psoriasis, interestingly enough. So if fish is roasted with meat, you're not allowed to eat it. It's not non-kosher. It's perfectly kosher. The dishes and the utensils are all kosher. However, it's dangerous. Therefore, don't eat it. Well, that's...
Later, okay?
Sorry?
Later it can be eaten.
No, see, what they're saying here is if they're cooked together, never eat it.
Never eat it.
If they're cooked together, never eat it. If they're not cooked together, then you eat them in sequence and you clean your mouth out in between, and that's the recommendation. So I mentioned when I noted this in an earlier week that a friend of mine had actually suggested an explanation. So I went online and I found a place where he wrote this up in source number 2. There's more to it than this, and he wrote it up in on an email list when a dermatologist responded to him rejecting what he had said. But I brought it for you in number 2. I'm going to read it until I can't pronounce it any further. Recent research has found that stearic acid found in beef may actually lower LDL cholesterol, and he quotes to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. On the other hand, fish contains, and that's where I stop. The eicosapentaenoic acid, I think, maybe. Yeah? Sounds good? Okay. Sarah says I have my biochemistry right. Which has been found paradoxically to increase lipid peroxidation. And he quotes you a bunch of other journals. In addition, there may be an interaction in the liver between stearic acid and that acid. There is extensive literature on fish oil-induced diabetes. In psoriasis, there's increased lipogenesis, increased susceptibility to diabetes, increased tendency to thrombosis, and elevated plasma lipid levels. If you understood that, that's great. But his point is that he believes there is some kind of interaction going on, which could, among other things, create complications for people with psoriasis. Now, as I said, on this listserv where this message was posted, there's a dermatologist who responded that while each finding that he mentions here is legitimate, they don't add up in terms of fish and meat being cooked together leading to a problem. That he felt was not a correct conclusion. So you can go back and forth. I brought it only because it's interesting to see someone's actually trying to figure this out. But here's my question now. The Talmud says that this is dangerous. Does it have any credence? Should I believe it? Is there any reason to think that Talmudic sages would have had special knowledge? Or were they just writing down, you know, the science of their time? In their day, it was considered dangerous to cook fish and meat together because that was what was believed going back to the days of Galen. Doesn't mean this is an issue today. Right. Well, I'm actually going to come back to that because that's actually a very important point. I mean, not his wife per se. But the idea that this is done empirically. You observe things and you say, oh, okay, this is what we saw. I guess that means we should be careful. And that's, you know, a school of thought, as we'll see. Take a look at source number 3, which is a much more controversial one. The fish and meat people basically live with. You know, it's annoying to wash more dishes and whatever, fine. But the next one has been a very hot topic. This is something that is called, the Hebrew term for it is mitzitza. How many are familiar with the issue of mitzitza? Okay. So this is what starts it, source number three. After a bris, Rav Papa said, if a mohel does not draw out the blood, so it's like meats is juice in Hebrew. It's the if he doesn't draw out, suction out the blood, that is dangerous, and we remove him. In other words, for the health of the child, you need to remove the blood from the wound. Now, classically, historically, the way to remove the blood from the wound was oral suction. Today, many Moalim, including the ones who did the bris for my sons, used a pipette. They take a tube rather than themselves potentially infect the child with whatever they may have, whatever bug may be in their mouth. There have been allegations over the recent wave of it is the last couple of decades, but the truth of the matter is, there were reports about this more than 100 years ago, concern for infections happening and children being endangered. As a result of it, most popularly, the stories involve herpes infections, which is very dangerous for an 8-day-old kid. If you look at the way Rav Papa puts it, his statement is, it's dangerous if you don't do this. So much so that even though this could involve a violation of Shabbos, nonetheless, if you do a bris on Shabbos, you're obligated to also do this, to draw out the blood for the safety of the child. So it's a medical statement. This isn't a matter of a mitzvah of suctioning out the blood. The Torah doesn't say, draw out the blood. The Torah does say, guard your life, and this is a function of guarding your life, and it's a medical prescription. There have been those historically who wanted to argue it was also a mitzvah, but generally speaking, it's understood it's not. It was meant to protect the health of the patient. So again, here's the question. What if doctors say we have better ways to prevent infection? We have these neat things, right? The potions, ointments and creams and whatever it is that do a very good job. We can clean it out with gauze. We can use a pipette, whatever it is that we're going to do. Does this still hold sway? And what do you do if this actually is considered a dangerous practice? What if you're actually endangering the child because of whatever disease the Moel himself may be carrying? So that's a second example. And then I brought you the third one, source number four. This is tip of the iceberg. There's a passage in the Talmud, which this is part of, in the Navam called Gittin, which brings all sorts of cures, all sorts of therapies. So here is one that I brought you. This is the first one on the very long list. For head pain resulting from blood, right? Meaning a person has a headache, and it is believed that they have a headache not because, someone hit them in the head, but because there's some kind of buildup of blood. There's a lot within older medicine about buildup of blood, needing to let blood, and so forth. So if they think that it's something that's a result of the blood, this is what they should do. Bring shorbina, which is understood to be a type of cedar wood, willow, moist myrtle, olive, chilfa, chilfi diyama, and yabla. There are various translations for these last three species. There are some, each of them is some kind of either plants, like tree, or grass. So take all of these different woods, boil them together, and pour 300 cups on one side of the head. It's like waterboarding. And 300 cups on the other side of the head. And if at that point he's not begging for mercy, no, if that doesn't work, take a white rose, which has all of its petals on one side, whatever that means, boil it, and pour 60 cups on one side of the head and 60 cups on the other side of the head. Well, maybe because it has other side effects that you don't want to... maybe because it's hard to find a white rose with all the petals on one side. This is what we're talking about when we speak of the medicines of their day. And it's not just our medicines that were like this. You can read the works of Galen. They're out there. They're available. This was, normal. But the question is, so should somebody try this? And not this per se. There are all sorts of medicines that are found Talmudically. Are we supposed to assume that students of Torah have medical knowledge? And are we supposed to follow their prescriptions? And if so, why? Why should I make that assumption? Why should I think that they actually know what they're talking about? Now, in truth, Talmudic medicine is often surprisingly good. There are remarkable things that you find when you start doing research. There was a doctor by the name of Julius Preuss, going back about 100 years, who took a lot of the medicine found in the Talmud and found different ways to explain it in light of what was, in his day, modern medicine. All sorts of fascinating insights. It's published. I'm blanking now on the name of the book. It's a blue book, but I'm forgetting the name. But Julius Preuss, P-R-E-U-S-S, is his name, and it's a fun read. But even without, you know, his work, there's just a lot there that we do find to be remarkable even today. So take a look at source number 5. This is regarding the practice of amulet writing. The Talmud takes very seriously the idea that you could write an amulet. And it's not like taking a verse. You're not supposed to use biblical verses to try to cure a disease. That's actually a no-no. But writing incantations or whatever you'd write on it, and this could help to cure an illness. And this idea of amulets was not our own, of course. Others had it, but it persisted until, I'd say, 300 years ago. As a common way to treat disease. But what I want to talk about is not the amulet per se, but the sages talked about the need for the amulet to be what's called an expert amulet, a certified amulet, because of a law. There is a rule that says I'm not allowed to transport things in the public domain on Shabbat. What if somebody is ill and they're walking around with an amulet around their neck for their disease? Are they allowed to walk around outside with the amulet on? And the answer is, it depends. Sorry?
They're wearing it.
If it's part of their...
Right. So wearing depends on whether something is considered to be clothing. Meaning the fact that I say I'm wearing something doesn't turn it into clothing. It has to be something that people view as clothing. And there are other elements to it as well.
As clothing?
Sorry?
Talit
would be viewed as clothing because it is. I mean, the reason I need tzitzit strings on it is because it's a because it's a garment. But for example, to use a popular example, if we have no eruv, if I'm not able to carry, and I need to get my key from one place to another, putting it on a string and putting it around my neck doesn't work. I need to make it part of jewelry. So there are people who made it like a backing for a brooch, or I had a belt at one point in which it was the, I don't know what to call it, the piece that would fit into the hole. That was the key, in order to do it. So there are all sorts of ways you could make it a part of a garment, but it has to be part of a garment. So without going too far into that, the point is your amulet doesn't necessarily qualify unless it's a certified amulet. Well, how do you get certified? So take a look at source number 5. This is the Talmud's explanation. Success with 3 kinds of amulets for 3 different people on 3 occasions for each kind of amulet certifies the writer and the amulets. In other words, if you have somebody who is an amulet writer and he prepares for 9 different patients. You have 3 patients with each kind of disease. So 3 people with this disease, 3 people with this disease, 3 people with this disease. And he prepares an amulet that these 3 wear, an amulet that these 3 wear, and an amulet that these 3 wear. And they all get better with that. No one dies, no one gets worse, whatever it is. It works for all 3 of them. Then you have succeeded in certifying the amulet because it worked for 3 people in sequence. And also, the writer is now somebody who is trusted. So if he comes up with another amulet for another problem, we're also going to accept what he does. That's what they're saying. You need to see it work 3 times, and I believe it's in a row. So success with 3 kinds of amulets for 3 different people on 1 occasion for each kind of amulet certifies the writer, but not the amulet. Let's say you have 3 different diseases. And he writes an amulet for 1 and the guy gets better. Writes an amulet for the next 1 and the guy gets better. Writes an amulet for the 3rd 1 and the guy gets better. But each amulet is different.
All 3 of them are kosher, and if it's a new one, I guess it's not.
Well, what we're saying here is the amulets themselves are not credible in their own right because they only cured 1 person. But the writer has proven his ability, and so anything he writes, we're going to be good with. But if somebody else were to write the amulet like he did, that wouldn't be trusted. We wouldn't assume that it's okay, because that writer doesn't have a track record. The amulet itself doesn't have a track record. It's the writer of this one who did for three people. He's the one I'm going to be okay with. And then the last line, success with one kind of amulet for three different people certifies the amulet, but not the writer. Right? You may be really good at curing strep throat, but nothing else. So, if you wrote an amulet for strep throat for three people who had strep, so it's good. We know this amulet is good. We don't know that you know what you're doing for anything else. So the point that I wanted to show you here is not that you should actually try this at home, but I think it's a fascinating method of testing. It's not a double-blind experiment. You didn't have the amulet writer write, you know, for people who didn't have anything. You didn't have somebody else write for the patients who were ill to have, you know, to try them out and see what happens when they write. Look for a placebo effect, and like none of that actually happens in this case. The point, though, is they're looking at it in what is for their day a scientific way. It's empirical evidence. We're looking to see did it work. They're not discussing theory. Why should it work? But did it work? Yes, Stephen and then Diane.
I multiply it out, it seems 81 times. 3 times 3 times 3 is 27, and there's 3 threes, it's 27 times 3. Has to work 81 times in each instance. With each,
I think it is not 81. I think, but I wouldn't get hung up on the number of it. But yes, in other words, we're not just saying anybody could hang out a shingle and say I'm writing amulets.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Diane.
I was just thinking in the 1600s, if you did that, you'd be burned at the stake. I know a lot of women suffered that way.
So I'm not sure that came from amulet writing. Because I think amulet writing was actually considered normal.
Is that considered normal?
That's my understanding. To look it up.
Witchcraft.
Doesn't it?
Where is the crossover?
To us it does. Well, here, that's actually a very interesting point. Sean is in 1 second. That's actually a very interesting point because Maimonides, when he discusses issues of an acceptable medicine, says we reject what he calls segula, which he explains to be medicine for which we have no theory explaining why it should work. He says you're not allowed to. However, in the event that medicine is tried and you see that it does work, then we accept it and just say, well, I didn't understand, I don't know the theory yet, but clearly it's effective. So there is a recognition that, you know, if you were to take, let's say, penicillin and go back a couple of hundred years, they would call that witchcraft also. Right? The theory of why it should work wasn't known to them. So there was a recognition of we don't know everything, and there was less of a reliance on theory and more of a reliance on what did we observe, what did we see happen. Shauna.
So this ties into what you were talking about. So there's different kinds of healing medicines in our day and age, like healing touch and Reiki and things like that. And
yeah.
I know some people who have practiced Reiki, they write symbols or have incantations, but is that considered like trade, or is that a whole big other topic in question?
Right, so it's definitely a whole other topic in question. If you want, I have, maybe I'll send out later a link. I have given a class on the issue of alternative medicine and what establishes something as alternative, so maybe I'll send out the link for it, and you can download that and listen if you like. But it's very controversial. That's the short answer, is that it's very controversial. Generally speaking, Jewish law has tended towards liking the board certification type of method and that which can be explained by theory or something close to theory. It's been much less comfortable with something like that. So that's one example of this. They follow the scientific methods of their day. You know, and that's number 5. Number 6 is another example. This one I found absolutely fascinating. A maid in Shmuel's household. This Shmuel is not Shmuel Samuel the prophet. This is Shmuel from the end of the 3rd century in Babylon. So a maid in his household suffered from a burning eye on Shabbat. Not like a burn like scalded, but like a feeling, a sensation of burning. She cried, but no one paid attention. They thought, it'll pass, whatever it is. And her eye erupted. No explanation for what erupted actually means. The Hebrew there could actually be rendered as split, but I don't begin to know what that means. Haka, pei kufayin, which is related to the, and that's Aramaic technically, but it's like bet kufayin in Hebrew.
Be like, out.
Yeah, it really could. The next day, Shmuel lectured publicly. If an eye revolts, ayin shem morda, he says, one may treat it with kachol on Shabbat. Kachol was a type of a blue dye that I believe was alcohol-based. And it was used to treat the eye, and it also doubles as eyeshadow. I'm not kidding about that. That's actually this. I had an Arabic professor who said, I think I mentioned this in a class at some point in this room, that the word alcohol is from the Arabic, al-kukhla, and that kohl was alcohol-based. The problem was that I started looking into this kohl dye. I didn't see alcohol in the ingredients. But anyway, somebody had a bottle. But he says, if an eye revolts, one may treat it with kohl on Shabbos. And then he says, why? Because the nerves of the eye are linked to the fat around the heart. Now, you look at that and say, this is another example of something really strange. However, take a look at source number 7. Dr. Yaakov Levy, writing in Hamayan, quotes you an 11th century work called the Aruch, Rabbi Natan Bala Aruch. It's an Italian work. The Aruch records a reasonable explanation that this is an expression of revolving, the eye, you know, moving around a lot. And he says, when the doctor sees that a patient's eye is revolving, he is concerned for danger to the entire body. The disease of the eye has disturbed the flow of blood, which is based in the heart's activity, and this is identifiable in the brain. Now you look at that and say, I don't know what he's talking about, but that's because I only translated you a small paragraph from a much larger piece. If you want to see more about this in English, take a look at number 8, which describes what I believe the Gemara was talking about. Something called the oculocardiac reflex, which is familiar to physicians today, and they make use of it. The oculocardiac reflex, also known as Aschner phenomenon, Aschner reflex, or Aschner-Dagnini reflex, is a decrease in pulse rate associated with traction applied to extraocular muscles and or compression of the eyeball. The reflex is mediated by nerve connections. Bradycardia, junctional rhythm, and asystole, all of which may be life-threatening, can be induced through this reflex. In other words, by compressing the muscles around the eye, you can actually affect the person's heart rate. That's the upshot of it. That's not new. That's not novel. Paramedics know about this. I know because I've discussed it with them. But that is likely what they are referring to in terms of the eye-heart connection, what we today call the oculocardiac reflex. So it's not like all their medicine is just, you know, pour 300 cups of this and 300 cups of that, then, you know, call me in the morning. There are substantive elements. One more that I just had to bring is source number 9. I just gave you the link. I'm sure you've seen studies like this. The business of chicken soup, right, being good for you today. I thought it was another piece that I had brought on here, but I must have taken it out in the interest of space. I had another piece that I wanted to bring, a passage in the Talmud that speaks about something called pedata, which is a wound as a result of metal. Metal cuts a person's skin. It's an Aramaic term. Pedalid ayin tav aleph, pedata. And what it says there is that it's considered to be life-threatening. If a person gets a cut with metal, it needs to be treated on Shabbos because it is life-threatening. What's presumably what they're concerned about?
Tetanus.
They don't have the theory to go with it, but they have what they've observed. And they know that this is considered to be dangerous. However, all of this does not necessarily speak to the value of Torah as a medical text. I keep saying all along, we observed this, and therefore we knew it. It's not a function of, I learned a verse in the Torah and deduced from it how to test amulets, or deduced from it the oculocardiac reflex. It's, we saw that people had certain conditions and were harmed, and therefore we knew it's serious, or we saw people had certain conditions and this helped them, and therefore we assume that this is a therapy, and either you get it right or you get it wrong, because sometimes you deduce incorrectly from the data that's in front of you. But not all of the medicine should be discarded or discounted just because it's old. But let's go back to the core question. Why would a student of Jewish tradition expect that Torah should convey medical information or any scientific information? Yeah.
Well, in that time, the wise men were considered universally, I think, to be the people that had knowledge. And, of course, if one is ill, then the knowledge of the of a cure would be put at the feet of the wise men as opposed to just John Lowe.
Right, but why would someone go to wise men who are educated in, let's say, the Torah, as opposed to going to wise men who are trained medically? Why would I assume that the Torah gave that qualified them to take care of medicine?
That's our entree to wisdom.
Mm. So one way to look at it is that, yeah, as Ruth says, Torah is your entree to wisdom. This is how you... This Torah is not something in a vacuum, but it's actually wisdom at, you know, in general. If you take a look at source number 10, I think this is what you were suggesting. It's a mishnah at the end of Pirkei Avot, end of the main part of Pirkei Avot. In the Hebrew it goes, Hafochba v'hafochba dekulaba. It's technically Aramaic. Hafochba v'hafochba dekulaba. Turn it and turn it, for everything is in it, for all is in it. The assumption is Torah is complete wisdom, not only partial wisdom. Shauna, you were going to say?
I'm just going to say, if there's the belief that Torah was given to from God on Mount Sinai, and God is all-knowing, and God gave it, just to link into that, then exactly what you just said, that everything we need to know would be in Torah.
Except that also assumes a motivation. That assumes that, yeah, it starts in the step of God knows everything. Check. And it concludes with, God gave us Torah, which should include all of the knowledge that he possesses.
No, all the knowledge he wants us to have.
All knowledge he wants us to have. So maybe Torah is specialized, and it's not all the knowledge, you know, that we should have. But that would then lead to a question, well, then why didn't God also have a special medical conference and give us another book with all medical information?
More like a question. I mean, yeah. At that time, there were special people
I'll repeat.
Among the wise that specialized in taking care, medically taking care of people.
Right.
That's it. What do we know about the medical care at that time?
Right.
I mean, were there like people who were considered doctors at that time?
Well, if you go back to Talmudic times, definitely. Meaning, you're already in the Greek era at that point, and you have physicians and people who specialize, and Galen is technically before most of the Talmudic sages. And you know, he trains by treating the gladiators. That's his training. I imagine he saw certain types of disease and illness more than others. But the point is that there were doctors, and some of the sages were known for practicing medicine. Shmuel, who we mentioned before, whose mate had the eye problem, was a doctor, and he quotes medical ideas frequently. There is also popular medicine, meaning the sage Abaye in the 4th century has a series of comments in the Talmud in which he says the woman who raised him, he was an orphan, but he was raised by a woman who he calls his mother. So he says, Amra li, my mother told me, and then he presents various cures, that, you know, therapies for diseases that his mother, you know, used or taught him. So there was also popular medicine, separate from professional medicine. So there is this idea that there were doctors, and then there was medicine in general. Yeah.
Also, I don't know if I came a little late, I don't know if you touched on this already, but Rambam also has all these rules about, like, not drinking while you eat, and how you should eat, and different
right.
ways to eat.
Right. Well, he's already much later.
Right.
Right. He's already 12th century, but it's true. Maimonides, he wrote medical texts. He included medicine in his works of Jewish law. But separately, he wrote medical texts. He had a commentary on the works of Galen. He loved Galen, except when he didn't. But that's already moving us, you know, beyond the core times that we're talking about. But take a look at number 11, because this goes back to some of the points that have been mentioned. The idea that God has this medical information, of course he would convey it to us. Passage out of the Talmud. Mar Zutra, son of Rav Nachman, asked Rav Nachman. So we're talking about, I believe, 5th century Common Era. What is gout? He asked. Meaning, how does it feel? Was the question. He replied, like a needle in raw flesh. What happens is, the immediately preceding passage speaks about a figure in Tanakh who had problems with his feet. And they commented, the Talmud is, yeah, what he had was gout. So the student here asks his father, Mar Zutra, asks Rav Nachman, what exactly is this? He said it's like a needle in raw flesh. To which the Talmud then asked, well, how did Rav Nachman know that? So, first answer is, perhaps he experienced it. Maybe he had gout. Second, perhaps he learned it from his teacher. I mean, he had a teacher who told him there was a tradition from people who had it that this is what it is. Or perhaps they quote a verse from Tehillim, from Psalms, the secret of God is for those who revere him and his covenant to inform them. So, Hashem l'rayav u'brito l'hodiam. It is God's secret to convey to people, and in other words, somehow he got this information from God. Now, in truth, we actually saw a couple of weeks ago the idea that even the world's scientific knowledge came from us first. Right? You remember when we were talking about Copernicus and the writer of it, David Gans, who said, yeah, they got their science, their knowledge, all came about through us. And for a great example of this, if you look at number 12, I gave you a link. I wanted to reproduce the picture from that page here, but then it would have required a whole other page, and honestly, the diagram is very hard to understand. But the story is this, the story behind the link in number 12, and then you can go to the link and see it for yourself. But the story behind it is Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz was one of the leading authorities in Jewish law in the middle of the 20th century. He was mostly known as Chazon Ish because that was his major work of Jewish law, and classically within Jewish tradition, we name rabbis based on the names of the books that they wrote. So he's called Chazon Ish. So at some point, he had a student who had some kind of a brain tumor, and this is 1930s, 1940s, goes to the doctor, diagnoses it, goes to the neurosurgeon. Neurosurgeon said there's nothing you can do. Number one, this is like terminal. It's already, you know, too late. But number two, there's no way to get to the tumor. Student goes to the Chazon Ish, who draws him a diagram, which we have. It's not, you know, some fable. We have the diagram, along with a letter, which we have, explaining how to go in and get the tumor. And they do the surgery. The neurosurgeon does the surgery and is successful. So, sorry?
How did the Chazon Ish...
So that's the big question. Diane asks, how in the world did that happen? What are you talking about? Why does that work? To which there are two schools of thought. Even though this was not that long ago in the passage of time, nonetheless, we have two full-blown schools of thought. One school of thought says, because he studied Torah, therefore he had insight into anatomy, and he knew, based on what he had been told about where the tumor was, he knew how they could go in to get it. And that's one approach. Along the lines of the verse that was quoted in number 11, the secret of God is for those who revere him. God conveyed him the information through Torah. The other school of thought is that the Chazon Ish, like many other rabbis, read up on medicine as well. He read journals, and he had access to the information, and so, yeah, he had this approach that he felt was worth doing based on the reading that he had done. I've been told that students of his say, yes, he was known to have actually read up on the science, and that's why he was able to provide this information.
Was he multilingual?
Oh, he was definitely multilingual.
Yeah. Perhaps the science was in a language, a different language.
Right. He's originally Eastern European.
Right.
He
had two languages.
Yes.
In the family, say the science was written in German, and the doctor in New York didn't speak German. Perhaps he could have read the German version.
Right. So I don't know enough information to know who, you know, all the players and which languages they spoke and so on, and why he knew what the neurosurgeon did not. It's entirely possible that he was more daring than the neurosurgeon, because it's not his insurance that he has to worry about. That's also, in other words, it could be the surgeon, you know, thought, well, that's too risky, and he said, look, you got to save the guy's life. You know, this is the way to do it. But my point in bringing it is actually not the story, as fun as the story is, but the debate that emerges from it. So how is it that he had this information? Is this something that's supposed to come through Torah, or is this something which is from medical journals? One view is that the perfection of Torah as God's message must include medicine. The other reason why there's an expectation that they'll know it is because of the practical impact we've already talked about. It affects Jewish law. How am I supposed to practice Judaism, which in many ways intersects with scientific knowledge, if I don't trust the scientific knowledge that went into it? You know, it's one thing to say, well, who cares, I won't eat fish and meat. But what about when you get to the mitzitzah discussion, this issue of suctioning out the blood, right, where you're dealing with potential life and death issues? Do you trust the medicine? There are many areas of Jewish law in which this comes up. I brought you a couple of examples. I could have brought you many more, and not just in medicine, but science in general. I'm going to up the ante. Take a look at source number 13. This requires a little bit of explanation. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, dealt with the fish and meat question because, interestingly, when Maimonides writes his work of law, Mishneh Torah, he includes various dangers identified Talmudically as well as dangers that he identifies, and he says you have to stay away from, and he doesn't mention the fish and meat thing. And so that leads to the question of, does he not believe that this is actually dangerous? So various approaches were suggested. Take a look at number 13 now, Rabbi Moshe Sofer addresses this issue. Rabbi Solomon Luria wrote, Rabbi Shlomo Luria is, I believe, 16th century in Poland. So he says, Rabbi Shlomo Luria wrote, based on the fact that Maimonides did not cite the Talmudic passage prohibiting fish roasted with meat, we see that in Maimonides' expert knowledge of nature and medicine, he was aware that their vapor would not cause harm. The mix of whatever steam from one into the other isn't a big deal. That's what Rabbi Luria wrote. He said, Maimonides knew fish and meat are fine. It is well known, Rabbi Sofer says, that this is a forced answer. For then Maimonides should at least have mentioned that one may not actually roast fish and meat together. In other words, if you think that it's only that the vapor isn't an issue, but that if there's physical contact it would be harmful, he should have said so. He doesn't like that answer. So then he says, it first occurred to me that Maimonides held that Benita is a specific fish, that Benita is the fish mentioned in the Talmud there, when they talk about not roasting them together. So maybe it's only one kind of fish that's dangerous with meat, and that this specific type of fish is prohibited with meat due to danger, but not other fish. Maybe it's only that fish that's harmful, and the Benita is not found among us. And so Maimonides excluded it. He said whatever fish they were talking about isn't an issue anymore. But he says that appears strained too. For that fish surely has not been extinguished in its own land, and so Maimonides should have mentioned it for the sake of the people who live in that land. Maybe some reader of Maimonides lives in a place where they have this Benita fish, whatever it is. So he says, it appears more likely that in his great knowledge, Maimonides knew and understood that nature had changed regarding this. We've talked about this idea of accepting that things change over time. Physiology may change, as we find in a variety of cases. Since we see that Maimonides, whose power innate in medicine and nature was great, omitted this law, it must be that he experimented and found that nature had changed in this matter. That's why Maimonides didn't record it. So now, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, I have a question for you. Are you willing to permit it on that basis? Are you willing to tell people, eat the fish and meat, don't worry about it? He says, we would not depend upon this in practice, to permit eating fish and meat together. For perhaps this is considered a practice which has been banned by a court's decision. In other words, maybe once the rabbis identify the practice as dangerous and say you should avoid it, now that makes it actually prohibited. Maybe that becomes like a law of the Torah. And that's what he suggests. Therefore, we are careful, and the custom of our ancestors is Torah. That's what he says. But it's not called dangerous. Now it's just a law. And there are advantages to that, because we take danger more seriously than we take most of Jewish law.
It's a law or a
mitzvah? So he views it as law. As though the rabbis had made a decree, rabbinic decree, fish and meat are now not kosher, so to speak. That's what he's floating out there. So now, that raises the stakes. Now you're telling me that whatever they say scientifically may have the force of law behind it. Can't change it now. Oh boy. That makes things very difficult. One more source before we get to an answer. Number 14. Rabbi Shmuel Edels wrote a commentary to the Talmud called Maharsha, as you see there, 16th, 17th century Poland. He asks a question which every student of Talmud asks when they reach these passages of medicines. what is this doing in my Talmud? The Talmud is, for the most part, a work of either law or ethical instruction. Right? I couldn't assign percentages, really, to say what percentage is which, but the bulk of it is law. Law for, you know, a remarkable gamut of situations, ranging from daily life, prayer, Shabbat, holidays, zoning laws, tort law, sacrifices, purity, you name it. It's all there. Marriage, divorce, everything is there in terms of law. And there's a lot of content that tells stories or that analyzes biblical verses in order to teach ethical lessons. But every once in a while, you come across, if a person has a headache due to blood, they should, you know, boil up this wood and then pour 600 cups on their head. And you just look at it and say, like, why? Who wrote that into my Talmud? What's it doing there? And so that's what Marsha wants to address in source number 14. He mentions Ravina and Rav Ashi, two 6th century sages who are credited with the canonization of the Talmud. Why did Ravina and Rav Ashi record these in the Talmud? Doesn't Brachot 10b record, this is actually, he's asking a separate question here. The other question is also a valid question, but now he's asking a separate question, which is, you're not supposed to teach people all the different medicines that are out there, because if you do, they won't rely on God at all. They'll just turn to their medicine cabinet. The Talmud records, explaining a verse in Isaiah, that Chizkiah, the king, King Chizkiah, buried a book called the Book of Cures, so that people would pray for mercy, and the sages praised him for it. Now, mind you, that's its own discussion, because there's a lot of debate as to what the Talmud means about this Book of Cures and why he buried it, but it's not for the moment. But his question is, so why are you writing all these medicines in here? One could answer that permission certainly is given to heal, right? You're allowed to cure people and to know the cures of all illnesses. But one may not reveal all of them to everyone because of people who are not good, who will not trust in God but in their medicine. He says, yeah, there's an idea of not publishing medicine to everybody. That's true. But it was permitted for them to record the cures and reveal them to the public because one could not remember all of them by heart unless they be forgotten. So they said, we have to record it in a place that people will know it. So we put it in the Talmud, and that way everybody will learn it. Also, because of this, people will see that the Talmud is not lacking any wisdom, since for every illness, a complete and true cure may be found there for those who understand their language. The scorner will not say of the Talmudic sages that they were lacking medical knowledge. It's very important to him that Torah be credited with medical sophistication as well. Clear? With what we have so far? What we've said so far is that, number one, there's a very serious practical problem of, do I rely on the medicine found in the Torah? It impacts Jewish law. We pointed out that there are cases where we can identify good elements to the medicine of the Talmud. At the same time, that doesn't mean that it's Torah knowledge. It could be just empirical based on what they observed. We said there are two reasons to expect that the sages actually did know medicine. One, because if Torah is perfect, it should be included in there and God should convey it to them. That's the overarching approach. Or second, because it does impact Jewish law and therefore we would expect that they would know what they were doing. And that last point from Chatam Sofer in source number 13, it actually gives it the power of rabbinic law when they make a medical statement. So now we have to address the bottom line. Does that mean that I'm going to act on their medicine if I have this assumption that they actually knew what they were doing? So the answer is that nobody I have ever seen in Jewish law down through the ages ever said that you should use the medicine of the Talmud. Just the opposite. They said, do not use the medicine of the Talmud. Do not cook up all this wood. Do not find the white rose with petals on one side.
Can you pour 300?
No, not even on your husband's head. No, do not try this at home. They were very clear. They said, do not use this medicine. Take a look at source number 15, please. Yeah, sorry, I didn't rain on your parade. Take a look at source number 15. Rabbi Shrira Gaon wrote in 10th century Iraq, we must inform you that the rabbis were not doctors. And they stated general things they saw in their times one by one. These are not mitzvah matters. Therefore, you shall not depend upon these medicines. One should not practice any of them until after they've been checked, and we know with certainty from expert physicians that this will not harm or endanger someone. So our fathers and elders taught us and told us not to practice any of these medicines other than Qibla, which we know causes no harm. There was something called Qibla, which they had tested and they found to be innocent at any rate. It wasn't going to hurt anybody. The statement is made, do not use those medicines, so much so, there was actually a ban that was recorded on using those medicines. In source number 16, I brought you this from the work Maharil, which is one of the key original works of Ashkenazi Jewish law. It is prohibited to test any of the cures and incantations in the entire Talmud. For one cannot know their basic nature, and when they do not work, then people will mock and scorn the words, I should say words, of the sages.
So it's just medicines or methods also? Because then, what about the tzitza?
Yeah, he seems to say don't use any of it, unless you've tested it and found it to be innocent. But I would note one key point. And he makes the point that then what about this business of mitzitza, of taking the blood out? But their argument is, if you leave things as they are, if you leave things status quo, if you don't use our medicine, you're actually endangering the child. So it's not starting from zero and saying, well, using this is a bad idea. You're starting in the negative. You actually have potentially endangered the child. Their argument will be, if you don't do this, there's potential harm. So then that raises the question, which in modern times has been approached, which is, well, what if your therapy is itself harmful? In other words, the what do you lose method of answering this question only works if there's nothing to lose. Once the argument is, well, mitzitza itself may be harmful, that changes the equation. But the statement is, don't use the medicine, and two different reasons are presented for not using the medicine. One, you already saw in number 15. They're not doctors. Don't assume that everything is found in the Torah for the students of Torah. Maybe it's there somewhere, but you can't. That's not what's driving the medicine in the Talmud. It's not coming from there. That's number one. Number two, in their era, they didn't know everything. It's really along the same lines, I suppose, but I like this source because it's a more modern source. In number 17, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein wrote, in every generation, there are surgeries for more illnesses, whether because of new knowledge or new developments in nature. As we see in medicines that there are new developments, whether due to new knowledge or due to new developments in nature, he says, in both in terms of surgeries and in terms of medical cures, there's always new knowledge, new information, and they didn't necessarily know everything. There's progress, essentially. He's talking about the idea of things physiologically changing. He's going back to that idea that we talked about in terms of the fish and meat, and Ramosha Sofer mentioned here, or that we talked about a long time ago when the Talmudic sages in Roman times said that eating a certain fish close to when it's rotting is actually healthy and is considered a good thing to do. And by the 11th century, the 12th century, they were already saying this is a really bad idea. Either they had some kind of fish that's not the fish we're talking about, or things have just changed. I mean, in Roman times in general, they preserved fish for periods of time which today we would consider grossly unhealthy. It wasn't a Jewish thing. It was a general thing. Fish sauces were very popular back in the day. But one school of thought says, don't assume that their medicine is actually valid. That's one school of thought. The other school of thought says it's not them, it's us. Right? It's not you, it's me. That's the other school of thought. Go back to what Maharil wrote in number 16. He says, it is prohibited to test any of the cures and incantations in the entire Talmud, for one cannot know their basic nature. Meaning, I don't necessarily understand what they meant. Right? Going back to that, the cure with the pouring the stuff on the head, back in number 4, maybe it didn't work because I didn't know what tilfa was. I used the wrong wood, or I lost count. It's a 300.
He didn't go into detail, but he suggested that they did in the Talmud when he said to use a certain thing, like going back to the brain thing.
Yeah.
well, temperature, there's no recipe.
Right, we're missing a lot of information. You boil this stuff up. I hope you let it cool before you pour it on his head. It's a good point. I hadn't thought about that one. You're right.
We have details.
No, we're missing.
How are you going to know how to do it?
Right.
Put hot water and,
Right. I think the answer.
It's gone anyway. It's cold or hot.
Right. I think that the answer likely would have been, it's recorded for an audience which is familiar with these cures in general, the same way that, my grandmother's recipe, a pinch of this. If someone were looking at that, it's some other era, they'd look at it and say, well, what's a pinch? Like this. Yeah. Right. And that's the argument that Maharil brings. We don't know exactly what they were describing. We don't know the herbs. We don't know the methods. We don't know what boiling it means, to what temperature. There's a simmer, and there's a boil, and there's a high boil. Like, what?
Icing it cold.
Right. And then there's the argument that the world has changed, that the teva, that nature itself is different, and therefore it won't work. So they knew what they were doing, but it doesn't necessarily apply in our day. So what you end up with are the same two schools of thought. Everybody concludes, don't use their medicine. That's down the line. And there's a fear that if people try to use the medicine and it doesn't work, then you're going to undermine people's faith. But there are two different reasons that are brought. Either because, no, you don't study Torah to derive medicine. Even if it's there, it's not there in any way that we're going to figure out from it. And these medicines have no holiness to them, and it's just the medicine of their day. Or the other school of thought is that their medicine was good, the problem is with us. Now, that's all well and good when we're dealing with medicines. That's fine. However, meaning I don't know what they were talking about. I don't know the methods that they were using, like you pointed out, in terms of the in terms of boiling it. So the problem is that this only works when we're talking about their medicines. What about when we get to laws which do rely on their science? Because it's one thing to say, go to your doctor instead of going to the Talmud to find out how to cure a headache. That's easy. But what about when you get to the realm of law, and the law is science-dependent? So one example of that would be the Mitzitza discussion, drawing out the blood from the circumcision. What I want to discuss next week is the issue of this word, suddenly stop, I lost the word, spontaneous generation. The issue of spontaneous generation. If you go back a couple of thousand years, it was popularly understood that certain creatures were born from the dirt. They didn't have parents. They just came to be. And the idea still comes up every once in a while. It's talked about. Sorry? That's exactly what I mean. The question that we're going to have to deal with is this. There is a Jewish law. On Shabbos, I'm not allowed to kill creatures. However, there was permission to kill lice. Because lice were generated from sweat and dirt, and therefore they weren't truly considered to be a life form, and therefore you would be allowed to kill them on Shabbat. Today we generally believe that lice come from mommy and daddy lice. And so the question is, does that change the law? Does the law change when scientific knowledge changes? So that's what I want to talk about for our last topic, God willing, next week. Thank you.